thank you guys so much for joining us for the Hollywood Reporter Tony Nominees Roundtable. For those listening, I'm just going to introduce who I'm lucky enough to be sitting with here. Sarah Bareilles, the Best Actress in a Musical Tony nominee for Into the Woods. This is her third Tony nomination, her first for acting. Congratulations. Victoria Clark, a Best Actress in a Musical Tony nominee for Kimberly Akimbo. This is her fifth Tony nomination. She won Best Actress in a Musical in 2005 for The Light in the Piazza. We have Jessica Chastain, a Best Actress in a Play Tony nominee for A Doll's House. This is her first Tony nomination. Josh Groban, a Best Actor in a Musical Tony nominee for Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. This is his second Tony nomination. Corey Hawkins, a Best Actor in a Play Tony nominee for Top Dog Underdog. This is his second Tony nomination. And Ben Platt, a Best Actor in a Musical Tony nominee for Parade. This is his second Tony nomination. He won Best Actor in a Musical in 2017 for Dear Evan Hansen. Guys, thank you so much for being here. As I said to Jessica a moment ago, this is sort of the equivalent of fantasy football for Broadway for me. I'm so thrilled to have so many people I admire and love here. And I guess for our listeners, maybe the thing we can do in the opening round is just kind of go around the horn and talk about how you came to these roles that you're nominated for this year. Victoria, can we start with you? You have, I'll tee it up a little before you give your answer. You've done so many different kinds of amazing things over decades in the theater, but I cannot imagine that you have ever faced a challenge of playing anything like playing, originating this role in the musical version of Kimberly Akimbo, which had originally been a play, but now the gist is a young woman, 16 years old, but with a affliction that causes her to age, I think, about four times as fast as that, which means that you are going to be playing somebody at a different stage of life. And just, was that intimidating, exciting? How did this come about?
It was incredibly intimidating.
Yeah.
But I love the challenge of it. And I love being able to revert back to the joy and the physical spontaneity of being a teenager again. That, to me, was the most appealing part about the role. It's the biggest role I've ever done. I barely leave the stage. So that was also intimidating. It was sort of like, you know, if I was Tom Brady and someone said, you know, 20 years from now, someone went to Tom Brady and said, hey, we've got this great idea. Would you quarterback this team? But instead of one game a week, you do eight. And instead of like half a year, your season is going to be 52 weeks. That was sort of the proposal. So I did pause for a while.
Well,
thinking about the physical exertion.
Right.
And the emotional exertion of this particular role, because you didn't mention, but this particular fictitious disease comes with a life expectancy of 16. So she turns 16 in the show. So she knows she's facing her last days. And so it's been a wonderful joy / challenge / emotional journey to confront both the hilarity of that situation and the absurdity, which David Lindsay Baer and Janine Tesori have set up so brilliantly. But it's also, you know, confronting the mortality issue is deep and beautiful.
Just a quick follow-up on this. Is it correct that prior to this project, you were actually kind of considering hanging it up for singing and acting?
I had hung it up, way up. And but I mean, I was doing film and television and really enjoying that. But I doing what we do is so athletic. We're really elite athletes. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to put it out there and say that. I mean,
we know a lot about football.
But, you know, I think about this all the time, because what we do is we want to make it look easy so that anybody in the audience thinks they can just jump up on stage and be right next to us. That is the art of what we do. But it is so gruelingly, is that a word? Gruelingly, yeah. Difficult and athletic. And so that's what I think most people don't know, is how hard we work.
And so I guess you had some doubts yourself about whether or not you still were up for it.
Well, yes. And also many of our houses on Broadway were built as vaudeville houses and old houses. They're not accessible. There's no elevators in our theater. We go up and down those stairs. I mean, we're all laughing because we know what that's like. Yeah. In order for me to go to the bathroom, which I have one opportunity to do the entire show, I mean, I'm jogging up two flights of stairs and racing back down. And it's just, it's a joyful enterprise, but you know, if I didn't have a team of people off stage pushing me on stage, I don't know if I would actually make it out there. You all know the feeling of just like, and the supporting cast and all of our colleagues on stage, like we rely on each other. Because if we're having a down day, you know, we just have to look in the eyes of our scene partners and pray that they'll carry us through.
So Ben, in Dear Evan Hansen, you were playing a young man caught up in a web of his own lies. In this show, Parade, you are someone who's caught up in a web of lies told by basically everyone around him except his wife, played by Michaela Diamond, so great in this. Just tell us, I mean, your show here, Parade, first mounted in 1988, Alfred Urey, Jason Robert.
98.
But wasn't necessarily like a smash hit at that time. Mm-hmm. You, however, have, it's sort of been on the bucket list for a long time. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, you know, I'm a musical theater deep nerd, as many people many people at the table are too. And I think that Parade is a piece that's been like a hidden gem and like a beloved little piece of art that we all really cherish. You hear it all the time. There's been like productions now and then on sort of a lesser scale. Everyone sings it for auditions and showcases and pieces. And it's just a really beautiful piece of writing that, as you said, in 98, I think obviously there were people that recognized how special it was, but it didn't necessarily fall on ears that were completely ready to receive it and hear it. And for me, I love Jason Robert Brown, the composer, very much, and always did growing up, listen to his music. And as a Jewish person, especially, this story certainly was in the zeitgeist of my family. And, you know, for any that don't know, it's a true story about this man, Leo Frank, who was a Jew in 1913 from Brooklyn, who moved to Georgia and was wrongfully accused of a murder. And thanks to a trial marred by a lot of anti-Semitism, was wrongfully convicted. And during the 2 years that he spent in prison, there was a lot of resistance from the North and from other people to try to get him freed. And there was a lot of great momentum, also with the help of his wife, Lucille Frank. And just as his sentence was going to be commuted and he was moved to like a lesser facility and things were really moving in the right direction, he was sprung from his cell by an anti-Semitic mob and was lynched. And so it's, you know, you might hear that and think like, what a great musical. But I think, you know, for me, that's my favorite pieces are things that try to take challenging material. And I feel like the magic of musical theater is that like you get to see the inside of people's souls and like hear levels and details in them that you can't in any other form. And Leo is exactly the kind of character that I want to hear from in that way.
Yeah.
Particularly because he's become this like symbol martyr, larger than life idea, more so than a man. And so the way that Jason and the book writer Alfred made him into a person, he was always on my list, as you said, of characters I'd love to play. And when Michael Arden pitched me the idea, he's such a brilliant director, I was like, this is the perfect place with the perfect person.
And sadly, 25 years after the original production, it's actually feels to a lot of people sort of more relevant, even though we're further and further removed from the original, you know, the events that you're depicting. And just to that point, because I think it, you know, people may have a hard time wrapping their head around this, but who was greeting you guys the first few weeks of performances?
It was actually just one night. It was the first preview that we had. We had some neo-Nazi protesters outside telling our audience members and patrons who were on their way in that, you know, Leo Frank is a pedophile and you're glorifying a, you know, a murderer. And, you know, a lot of tropes that you hear all the time from neo-Nazi groups in regards to anti-Semitism. And then we're also hearing for any kind of scapegoated group with the trans community. And it's happened to many different outliers. But I think it was just a really urgent reminder of why we're doing this right now. And there's been all kinds of universe reminders along the way that this is the moment for this particular piece. And I feel like anti-Semitism is always kind of an undercurrent that's always there. And it happens to be coming into the light at this current moment, unfortunately, because it's on the uprise, but also because people aren't turning away from it, which is really hopeful, I think. And so it's nice to be telling a story where there's such an urgent reason. Obviously, any piece of art is worth telling, whether or not there's this like great political tie. And so the embarrassment of riches is to have a piece like Parade where you really believe in it as a piece of art. And regardless of what it's about, it's so well crafted. And there's so much to mine as an actor. And then on top of that, as Victoria was saying, when there are down days where you just can't imagine getting out there, there's this amazing fire underneath of like, there's such a tangible, real, urgent reason to push yourself out onto the stage.
Absolutely. Corey, it's been a few years since Six Degrees of Separation, and you chose to come back to Broadway in this revival of Suzanne Laurie Park's 2001 Pulitzer winner, which has since been chosen as the greatest play sent by the New York Times since Angels in America. So basically, I think they're looking at the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Was it material you were already familiar with? We should just say you're playing Link, as in Lincoln, one of these two brothers. His brother is Booth, or as he wants to now be called, Three Card. And was there something about the story of these two guys that made you want to come back for this particularly?
Well, the appeal here was definitely Suzanne Laurie Parks. I mean, because the plays that they, you know, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage, as they say. But also to be able to work with Kenny Leon, I've been bugging him, blowing his phone up. I'm like, bro, we have to work together. We have to work together. And we just never been able to do it. And then Yaya was on board already. And I thought Yaya was going to obviously be playing the older brother, and because he's a couple years older than I was. And then he was like, no, I'm playing Booth. And I was like, oh, okay, so I guess I'm playing Link. And then, which was a challenge in and of itself, but it was just a joy to be able to bring this play back to Broadway. I knew of it, and I remember at Juilliard, we saw they had done a production of it, and, you know, we were in Theater Blacks moving stuff around, you know, and I just remember being just enamored with this piece. Suzanne Laurie Parks wrote an ode to Black men and allowed us to be our full, beautifully complicated selves. It's a piece of poetry. And it really does talk about Three Card Monty. It plays this, like, this trick with the audience and sort of lulls them into this false sense of security. And then it pulls the rug out from under them at the end. So that was the appeal was there.
And do you think there's something that it says in 2023 that maybe wasn't even there in 2001?
I think it's always there. Which that idea of living in this skin and walking in this world, the world changes around you, but that as a Black man, it doesn't change, and it hasn't changed. The challenges. Lincoln has to leave every day, go down to an arcade, sit there. He has to put on white face, and he has to be shot, you know, in an arcade by children, by adults, by school. Like, you know, it's interesting to kind of mental challenges he has to jump through to live his life outside, to make a living. And then he comes home. And it's sort of great to watch these brothers in this, like, castle that they create, you know, and watch them wrestle and play. So, yeah, I don't know that it's changed. I think those challenges are still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah, you, of course, I think first crossed most of our radar with, you know, non-theatrical specific singing, songwriting. But then you're progression since then to where you are getting nominated for performance has been really interesting, because correct me if I'm wrong, but basically for Waitress, it's the music and lyrics. Then Jesse Mueller steps out and, all right, we'll give it a try. You step in. But even before that, and first we should say that's a Baker. Now you're the Baker's wife in Into the Woods, but you had actually been interested in Into the Woods before performing in Into the Woods before Waitress, right?
Yes.
So what's the root of your particular draw to that production?
Baking. It's really just about the pie.
Yes.
No, I think, like many people, I got exposed to the PBS great performances Into the Woods very, very early on. Actually, back when I auditioned for the Mickey Mouse Club and didn't make it. But I was, my vocal coach sat me down to prep me for my audition, and she played Into the Woods just as a part of just getting into the psychology of performance and what is captivating on stage, and trying to sort of make, you know, those connections for me. And I was, I think, 12 years old at that time. But when I moved to New York 10 years ago, I was pursuing theater, as I thought, as a performer. And I got an audition for the production of Into the Woods that was in the park. and I auditioned to play Cinderella. And can I say shit the bed on here?
Please.
Because when I just, the audition was so deeply humbling and so pathetically terrible. I had, it gave me so much reverence. And I was like, oh, I'm not prepared to engage in this world in any way. You know, my music background had not prepared me for the rigor and the necessary preparation. It just gave me a lot of appreciation for that. But Jessie Mueller got that role. As she well deserved it and was wonderful in it. And then, yes, full circle moment, you know, I guess maybe 4 years later, after writing the music and lyrics for Waitress, Jessie was, yeah, our first choice to take over the lead for that. And it was really beautiful. It's a wild ride and how to get here. And I'm very grateful for it.
And then just, I mean, the fact that there even was this 2022 Into the Woods, I mean, it was never really planned, right? You guys heard it was going to be 2 weeks.
2 weeks for City Center Encores series. I said yes many, many months prior. Loved the idea of a short stint because after having been on Broadway and what Victoria was talking about, the incredible athleticism, and I was planning on writing a record last year, and my life was going to look very different. But as it does, you know, the art wants what it wants, and it is... Oh my gosh, that sounds like the heart wants
what
it wants.
It does. I'm putting that on a t-shirt.
Yeah, I do it. I want half. But it bloomed in this really beautiful and unexpected way. I can't tell you how shocking and delightful it is to be amongst all of you and to be a Tony nominee for performance means the world. It's just beyond. So yeah, really, really excited.
Well, we are going to stay on the topic of Sondheim-related stuff for a second because Josh, of course, Sweeney Todd first performed in 1979, 2 years before the birth of Josh Groban. you also, like Sarah, first crossed our radar, and I think it's correct to say non-theatrical singing, or may have been theatrical, but not in the theater. And
I've always been hammy.
But then you came and starred in what I really think might be my favorite theater-going experience ever, which was Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And that was your first time on Broadway. Yep. Went very well. To come back now, though, in something that has such a history and legacy, I guess just what was the, I think for you as well, this had been something that, a part that was on your radar from when you were a kid, right?
It was a part that I loved ever since I was a kid. I didn't necessarily always think that I would be right to do it. It was just something that I loved to listen to, loved to see other brilliant performances of it, loved the show. I mean, I think whenever you get to, hold the torch for a moment for a show that we've loved for 40 years. You have a responsibility to not mess it up, and you have an equal responsibility to add what you add to it. And you got to honor it in both ways, bring a freshness and also a reverence for what's been there before you. And so there's a lot that I've been able to have as kind of a student of that score for many, many years. We did kind of a roundtable discussion with some previous Sweeneys,
yeah.
And Len Carreyrou was there, and we were all just kind of marveling at the idea that Len is the only Sweeney that never heard another Sweeney, you know, that never got the music,
right.
You know, in real time,
right.
You know, and what that must have been like, because it's a crazy thing. But I've always been excited by the idea of stepping into something. That's something, of course, like Great Comet. There's a different challenge of something that's very new. And so you want to try and figure out the puzzle of presenting something that is a fresh listen for most audiences. And with something like Sweeney Todd, it's very easy to be a little bit cynical going into it that, oh, we're going to be doing it for people who've seen it 10 times. And we hope that we're one of the versions that people really, really like. We've been pleasantly surprised that there have been a lot of people who've been like gasping and crying at moments where you think like, oh, that's a first timer.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So we all feel very privileged to be able to present this masterpiece every night. We've all loved it for a really long time. We're all terrified in all the best possible ways. After I did Great Comet, we talked about the athleticism. Like, I was like, I want to do it just noises off next. I want to do something comedy. I was so, not that that's not athletic, but like the drama of Great Comet, I was thinking like, I just wanted slapstick, just something, just, yeah. You know. And then Sweeney Todd opportunity came about. So I'm going, put on the helmet, going back in. And just when I thought I was out.
And I think we should just note that you knew Sondheim before this project, right? Yes. And then he was going to be, I think, giving you guys notes, right?
We, you know, I feel very fortunate that some of those concerts that you mentioned prior to my time in the theater landscape were concerts for things like his birthday and things like that. I've always sung his songs, got to know him a little bit through that. I didn't really get to know him until Great Comet when I got a letter to Stage Door. He was obviously like an avid letter writer, and I got one of his letters, and he'd heard something and wanted to come to the show, and we kind of became, you know, I guess pals since then. And we were all really excited by his excitement for our revival. We knew that he had, we had his enthusiastic support of all of us doing it. And he passed away 2 days before our first music rehearsal. And so we don't get to speed dial and ask him, but he is now in that echelon of those great, you know, those greats where you just look at the work, you find it in the page, you find a new oboe part that you didn't consider. And you think, what did he mean by that? And you ask through the work of it, and we keep finding those answers every day. That's the fun thing about the repetition of it, is that by show 100, you know, you find a new thing, and we still are.
And I will just note, in case there are listeners screaming that I should know this, Victoria Clark's Broadway debut in the same theater where she is now doing her show was in Sunday in the Park with George.
Right? Oh,
so it was, and I never went on, so we can't really say it was my debut. I was understudying the two Celestes, the little girls who are fishing, and Frida, the German cook. And I had to learn, and each of those characters had a second act counterpart. So I think I had to learn 7 roles in 36 hours. The question at the audition was, do you read music? And how fast can you?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I was a director. I was a baby then. I just moved to New York as a director. Yeah. And I was at the NYU Musical Theater Program as a director. There was only 1 year. The Cycle One had added directors for their second year. So, so the casting people saw me and gave me this audition saying, you're not really a director, you're an actor. You need to come audition for this. And they gave it to me, and they had seen me learn material really quickly. So they knew I could.
And was he, this is 1985, was he
correct,
a presence there?
James Lapine was.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and there was another understudy who pushed me on stage early during a rehearsal that James attended. And
nice.
Yeah. And it was a comic moment.
Yeah.
I was like, I know this isn't right. And then I turned around and like screamed at the other understudy. Just wanted to like kind of undermine the whole thing. But, you know, fun understudy stories.
All right. Well, at long last, we come to Jessica Chastain. I think that it's pretty noteworthy that at maybe the hottest moment of a career that somebody could have, coming off of a Best Actress Oscar for The Eyes of Tammy Faye, as well as George and Tammy for TV, which is still cycling through its own award season now, you chose to come back to the theater. And it's not the first time, because the last time, which was your first time on Broadway, was right after the most insane year that anyone ever had in 2011, which was The Help and Tree of Life. And we can go on, like, I think there were 7 or something. So what is it that, when, you know, some people's inclination might be, all right, I better keep my foot on the gas of screen acting because it's going where I want it to go or whatever, you sort of have a inkling to come back to New York?
Well, I'm a New Yorker. I live in New York. Mm-hmm. Theater's my first love. It was something. It's a bit cliche, but it's the absolute truth. You know, as a child, it was the first time that I really felt part of something bigger than myself. It was the first time that I felt seen by a community of people and accepted, and I felt like I belonged somewhere. So for me, it's hugely important to my upbringing into the person I am. And so, you know, it being in that moment of in my career where it's like you could choose to do a lot of things, there's nothing else I really wanted to do but to come back and to get to do A Doll's House, you know, with Jamie Lloyd and Amy Herzog. It's pretty, which is also it's, you know, I've it's so important to me, the idea of women in our society, you know, and how we're valued. And so it just, every dot lined up in the way that I really wanted it to.
And even more than that, I think this was in the works for a few years, right? But when the pandemic hit, the plan had been to do it in London, right?
Yeah.
But Broadway was in trouble.
Yeah, so when I first signed on to do it, I was going to do it at the Playhouse Theater, Jamie Lloyd's company, and we were supposed to start rehearsals April of 2020, and I was very excited to start, and then the pandemic hit, and I spent a lot of time in New York just really devastated and walking around Times Square and talking to the people in our community, and, you know, in live theater really suffered for quite a long time during the pandemic. And so I called Jamie up and I said, I just don't want to leave my home. So is there any way you would consider doing it in New York? And he said, yes. And then when he agreed to do it in New York, he said, actually, you know what? We were going to use a different adaptation. He said, I've really been thinking I would like a woman to really look at this play. And that's how Amy Herzog came on board. And she's the first woman to adapt A Doll's House for Broadway. And I find it so exciting because Nora, in our version, in Amy's version that she adapted, she's complicit in holding up this society that oppresses her until she's not. And that is really interesting to me. She's not just this beautiful victim. She's participating in the beginning.
And just a quick follow-up. Like, you know, obviously 5 of the 6 of you guys are in revival. So, but in the case of A Doll's House, we're talking about 13 Broadway productions going back to 1889, literally on Broadway, including people I think that, or even, you know, in one version or another, forget about just the Broadway versions, like Leah Volman, who I know you love,
yes,
and all kinds.
And who came to our show recently.
Oh, really? Amazing.
Yeah.
So just like, does that, when you have, again, such a long history of people tackling a part, is that daunting, extra daunting, extra exciting? What is that?
Well, there's a great sisterhood. And when the first time I was on Broadway, I had the opportunity to do The Heiress. And I found out Cherry Jones was in the audience. And of course, her performance of The Heiress is monumental, right? And I found out, I was like, oh gosh, Cherry Jones is here. And I felt like this, oh no. Like I was so embarrassed to do it in front of her. And she came backstage and she had a gift for me. She goes, I have these books that I want to give you that I used when I was preparing to play Catherine's Lover. And also another actress gave them to me. She talked to me about the sisterhood and that we're all connected and we're all walking, you know, on these paths that others has forged. I mean, I was just like in love with Cherry Jones, you know, and we've worked together since then and I'm obsessed with her. But it was such a lesson in really honoring the people who have come before you, and not, I don't see it as something that's overly intimidating. I see it as that we're helping each other along the path and maybe discovering new things as we go.
Yeah. None of them have been done exactly in any of these revivals, but certainly I don't think there's ever been A Doll's House that had, you know, a Lazy Susan going around at the beginning
God.
Of the
and making eye contact things. With all the audience members.
Which we are going to come back. I want to talk to you and Ben about a variation of that in a moment. But I think we should know, because this is pretty, I was, you know, struck to realize this prepping. Every one of you, all 6 of you, your principal co-star in the show that you're representing here today is also Tony nominated. Wow. And so for Sarah, that's Brian D'Arcy James as the Baker. For Corey, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, we mentioned as Booth, Jessica Ariane Moayed as Torvald, Josh Annalee Ashford as Mrs. Lovett, who just won the Drama League Award, which is an amazing big honor. Ben, we talked about Michaela Diamond as Lucille Frank, Leo's wife, and Victoria Justin Cooley, who's Kim's friend, crush, whatever.
Slash
we won't
love
put
interest.
Labels on this. Yes, but I guess I just want to, you know, we don't have to go in any particular order, whoever wants to jump first. But, you know, when you have a, obviously these are all, almost all, you know, sizable ensemble, shows. But for these particular co-stars and the closeness with which you each work with them, can we talk about things that maybe you will remember most or take away most from that relationship. And I guess, Jessica, let's start this time with you and Arian.
Yeah, I love working with Arian. He has a wonderful way of being in the industry and being in the world, where he looks at an artist as a citizen, you know? And what are you contributing to society? And how are you using your art to become a good citizen? Mm-hmm. And that it's a beautiful thing to have someone dedicating their life to that. It's also so wonderful to get to act in a play like A Doll's House with him, because, you know, he's Iranian. And we talked a lot about what was happening over there, what is happening currently over there. He has so many people that come to see it and they say, you know, there's so many women who's like, this is what, you know, this is Iran right now. I mean, it's all over the world, yeah, right, sure, now. This idea of women fighting for their place in society. So it's wonderful to have him as someone to talk to about what's going on in the world, as someone to act opposite of. I mean, in our version, Nora helps create Torvald. He's not just this person who is emotionally abusing her and like death by a thousand paper cuts, as lovely as he seems. She has also created, she's participated in creating the person he is.
And just quick follow, are you able to extract any Succession spoilers from
Arian? Well, I'm also really good friends with Jeremy Strong.
Oh, Jeremy Strong, right, yes.
So I'm,
yes,
like surrounded, and Brian Cox came to our show. Right. I mean, I'm surrounded by the Succession folks, right, but I don't want to know ahead of time. I right, hate getting spoilers.
No, I agree.
And,
yeah. Sarah, I want to ask you, Brian D'Arcy James is one of the greats. I just saw him in the new musical version of Days of Wine and Roses with Kelly O'Hara, which is very exciting. But just working with Brian, I think you previously had a different baker at City Center.
I did. Neil Patrick Harris was my baker at City Center. And to be honest, the transfer to Broadway, I was very nervous about, because it really felt that the alchemy of our company at City Center, it just felt like we happened upon lightning in a bottle. And I took a minute to say yes, because I was asking myself, is this greedy? Are we being greedy just because it was popular? Are we trying to like extract more, or can we just let something be beautiful and ephemeral, which is what I love about theater anyway? But then ultimately I really came to just the profundity of this piece and how healing it seemed to be to the audience. I know it was for us inside of it, but so it felt like an exciting new chapter to get to tell the story again. Brian is the most generous, grounded, loving, hilarious man. He is, you know, iconic for a reason in this industry. He's the easiest person to work with. He's so fucking funny. It was really easy to find, you know, new colors to the relationship of the baker and his wife, who I named Rebecca because I'm like, she's not going to just be the baker's wife.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. My baker's wife is Rebecca. Nice. And yeah, he just was, he was so generous and malleable. And, you know, it's the challenge of discovering the same relationship on a new person. And just wanting to be really present, but he was really, it was so much fun to work with him. I would do it forever. He's the best.
Then Michaela Diamond, again, Lucille Frank was 20, I think, when you guys first started developing this together. She's now 23.
She is 23.
And I think her only other Broadway credit is playing
Cher.
Cher. She was one of the Chers in the Cher show.
Cher and Lucille Frank, no range at all. Yeah, she's extraordinary. I mean, Leo and Lucille were 23 and 29 when Leo was arrested, and that's our ages. And I think that we, you know, didn't necessarily expect, I knew she was going to be extraordinary. Like I had seen her in Cher, and I'd heard a lot of tell about her. And, you know, I've watched YouTube videos of her singing, and we also went to the same youth theater program here in the city at different time called Kids Theater with a Z. And I saw her play Victoria's Road in Light in the Piazza when she was 15 years old.
Oh my gosh, and I want to see that.
Let me tell you, it was really, really, I mean.
I bet.
You're an icon. It was pretty great. And so I knew that artistically I would feel very sort of equaled and challenged. But I think as a person, we just have really connected in a really profound way. We're both cut very much from the same cloth in terms of being musical theater babies and also Jewish kids who had similar upbringings. And we have a similar love and reverence for this particular show and for Jason. And I think that the marriage within Parade is where a lot of the joy and compassion and love comes from. And for us, you know, as wonderful as our company is, you know, obviously everyone is a beautiful person off stage. The experience of the show is very much everybody against the two of us. And so we are kind of on an island receiving a lot from everybody and a lot of oppression and isolation. And so it's got to be someone that you trust so deeply and who you can find joy with in the little cracks where it's afforded. And it couldn't be easier to find those things with Michaela. And falling in love with her every night and having the journey of sort of these two people seeing each other for the first time is what makes it so bearable and makes me excited to do it. Not that I'm not excited conceptually by the importance of it and the difficulty of it, but as a human being going and doing it 8 times a week, the thing I really look forward to is the joy in Michaela and I finding each other. And I really have just never felt so completely held, which is why I think we're both able to do the work that we're doing, is that we feel like we can fall flat and be okay because we're with each other.
And you, I mean, all of these are, you know, in different ways, such emotionally demanding shows that you're in. Jessica, at the end of your show, when you come out even for the bows, you're
going to give away the very...
No. Don't worry. There is a cool thing we will not say, but I mean, just you can't just turn it totally... You know, I don't know how anyone could just turn it totally on or off.
I begged to not do the curtain call.
You begged to not?
I begged. I said to Jamie, I don't want to give away the... Yeah. I mean, if you haven't read The Doll's House, you should read it. But, you know, I didn't think that I should come back for a curtain call. And it's also so quick right after this monumental thing. So I begged and begged. I said, wouldn't it be rock and roll to not do a curtain call or just me not show up? And then he goes, it's not for you, it's for the audience.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I get it. So I'm literally
Well, I mean, shaking. I bring it up just because, so that's you, that tells the listeners where you are at the end of your show. Ben, you and Michaela are clearly, you know, it's a grueling show to do. I want to go to Corey and ask about what you and Yaya did when this was running in the fall, which was that, you know, obviously it builds and builds to an explosive situation with the two characters. But then you and Yaya would shake hands at the end of each performance, right? In front of basically at the bows?
Well, yeah. I don't know if we planned. I think, first of all, I'm just thank you for asking about our co-stars.
Sure.
Because none of us would be able to do, I think, what we're doing without them or be here. And just really happy to see that. That's all being recognized. At the end, at our bows, we just needed to make sure that we touched each other. And whether it was a hug or just a hand on the shoulder or whatever it was at the end, because we were in such emotional, fragile places that I've never in my career had the opportunity to, or maybe had the guts to go there. And I thank him for allowing me that, because when we talk about this play, Yaya and I, that trust, everyone's like, well, how did you guys, you know, bond? How did you become brothers? And we were like, we're both artists. And we know, you know, from the jump, we knew the responsibility we had to come in and tell and speak these words every single night. And we also knew what the journey was, but getting there was a surprise every single night. And so people would come back 3 times and stand at the stage door and just ask us questions. And we'd be like, that's interesting. We're going to play with that next. You know what I mean? We'll see what we can find. But I equate it to running with stallions or like just, you know, I think there's this thing where horses, when they're running and they see that other horse, you know, sort of right beside them, they push a little bit further. Mm-hmm. There's something about that. It's the play is called Top Dog Underdog for a reason. And so there was a healthy, very healthy competitiveness with me and Yaya because it was throughout the play, you're constantly shifting. And so it was just great to be able to trust him. We spoke the same language, we're both trained actors. And to your point about making it look easy, especially that thing, especially like we're playing Black men in a particular station, you know, in their lives. And for a lot of people, they see us up there and they think, well, that's what they do. You know, that's easy. That comes easily or naturally. But to get up and do what everybody is doing, sometimes twice a day, you know, 3 hour shows, yeah. It takes a lot. And so you depend heavily on your partner and your co-star. And I was just really fortunate to have him as a brother to lift each other up because, it Top Dog took a lot.
Yeah, like, I can only imagine. Victoria, the dynamic with you and Justin Cooley is pretty interesting. First of all, how old is he?
Justin is 19.
19, and he has not been on Broadway
this
before?
This is his professional debut. His professional debut is at the Atlantic doing this role. And he came to the casting director's attention through the Jimmy Awards, which were, you know, on, what you call it?
Like
Zoom.
Theater, yeah.
Zoom, because of the pandemic. Right.
Oh.
So no one had ever seen him in person.
What?
Right. And so the Jimmy Awards have become this great sort of fertile ground for finding young actors. And and there's so many shows now that require, you know, really great kids who are, you know, on the verge, on the cusp of adulthood. And so the thing with Justin is that we met, you know, on the first day of rehearsal for the Atlantic, and we had an instant bond. It was one of those things where it was just an instant connection. Of course, I felt very maternal towards him. I'm 44 years older than he is. And yet we have to meet eye to eye as colleagues. So for me, that was such a beautiful experience to learn from him every night, because he doesn't have any hangups, right? Mm. He has no formal training.
Fresh eyes.
He has fresh eyes. He's very alert and responsive and grounded and beautiful. And it's so moving to do this piece with him, which is essentially this young girl facing the end of her life. And for Vicky, for me, to look at his face and not see too much life on his face yet, right? It's this beautiful. And even in the past year and a half that I've known him, you know, the mom in me can't help but notice, and my son's 20, almost 29 now, I can't help but notice how these features are maturing into, you know, a young man. When I met him, he felt like a baby, right? But he had like 20 minutes of insecurity on the first day, because I'm quite silly in rehearsal, and this show really brings it out in me. And we were improvising something that he wasn't really sure what I was doing. And I was like over in his like area, like at the camp, we have like his candy stand at the skating rink. And I was like handing him tortilla chips from my bag, or I was just making up all this stuff, right? And he was just frozen, because we were like in front of the director. It was our first day on our feet. We've done not that much book work. And he was just like, what am I supposed to do? And he kind of whispered to me, he's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And I was just like farting around with him. And and then we talked during the next break, and he kind of had a moment, and then that was it. Like, Jessica Stone has guided us all. We're all equals over there, you know, in the show. I can't be anything other than where I am at that age. I've only been on the planet 15 years. So there's a lot of my own life experience that I have to discard and just be in my body and be in this moment and learn from all of these incredible young people. I mean, it's been, I was so emotional listening to everyone talk about your co-stars, because we really can't do it. Like Corey said, we can't do it without having, and then too, we trust each other so much. And in order for us to be raw and honest, we have to know that we can fall into the arms of the people around us. It's really sometimes actually physically, right? We really lean on each other.
Well, and speaking of physical, there's so much physical comedy and stuff going on with Annalee Ashford and Josh in Sweeney Todd. She's, I think, more appreciated in New York than she should be more appreciated, equally appreciated elsewhere. But I think theater people know how good she is. And also just to have another Sondheim connection, she was Sunday in the Park with George.
Got in Sunday in the Park.
Yeah. And I guess I just wonder if you can talk about what, you know, how you guys developed so much of this is physical stuff, just how you guys worked it out.
I was first able to bear witness to just her incredible physical comedy and how she's able to just turn a phrase and communicate in Midsummer Night's Dream at Shakespeare in the Park. And I watched her just completely transcend up there and just thought to myself, I would love to do anything to bounce off that one day, to be able to just be and play in that space with her one day. And so we were part of that original music kind of workshop a couple of years ago. And, you know, we both felt the weight of responsibility. You know, we both had very big shoes to fill and wanted to make it our own and have fun with that. And she's brought so much of her own instincts to this role in a way that has been so incredible to just watch and be a part of in rehearsal. It's hilarious. And Sondheim, we knew, wanted Lovett to be a very much a hilarious take the wind out, you know, moments in the show. And she makes Sweeney funnier, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, but the other thing that we really wanted to lean on each other for, and we do check in like off stage every scene break that we have, because we know where we have to go. And we're always just, it's like a squeeze of a hand. It's just, are we okay? Like, and we do that just in general. I give Jamie Jackson, who plays Judge Turpin, a huge hug before and after each show, because I have to be seething with hatred for the whole show. But the other thing that Annalie really wanted to do that she brought so wonderfully was just to develop more of a kind of sexual chemistry and a romantic chemistry between Lovett and Sweeney that sometimes hasn't always been there, you know, that it's always been very, very much about their goals in life. And they're just kind of on two different boats that are next to each other. And she really wanted to make sure that there was that connection, that there was actually like a reason to believe that beyond their own goals, that there was behind the scenes, there was more going on there, which would make the breaking of trust even more heartbreaking.
Well, and there's a curse scene where she's basically seducing you while you're,
there's twerking.
I mean, it's like hilarious. Yeah, going on. It's
she's got the hots for Sweeney for sure,
right.
and their definition of love and want and is very different. They do have very different goals, but because there is such a give and take that she's brought to that role, there's so much more to play off of and bouncing off of the stuff that she brings and keeping it fresh like that every night has been such a joy for me. It's amazing to have a partner that you can trust like that.
With our next round, what I want to do is talk about some of the oddities and eccentricities of these productions that you guys are in. And this is where I'm going to come back to. We sort of referenced it earlier, but Jessica and Ben, you guys are on stage for extended periods of time when actors usually are not. Jessica, while the audience is entering the theater, I think it's like 15, 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then Ben, during the entire intermission, I guess, how did those decisions come about? And basically, in your mind, what does it add to your performance? And whoever wants to jump first.
Well, from what I gather, they're quite different, but I haven't been able to see Jessica because they started when we were already starting.
Right.
But, you know, Michael Arden, our director, came to me with this concept way at the beginning when he pitched me the whole production back in 2018, really. I mean, I got a little bit more detail when it came back together after the pandemic, but I'm pretty sure I already knew about it for our initial reading. But so it's definitely his idea, not mine. But I guess in terms of like what it means for the production, you know, Leo is convicted at the very end of the first act. It ends with his guilty verdict. There's no spoilers. This is a true story.
Right.
And he's immediately in this kind of cacophony of celebration, a very ugly celebration. He's put up in his cell and changed into his prison clothing and then sat in his cell and remains there for the intermission. And I think there's something very confronting and kind of uncomfortable about it, in the sense that this story isn't something that particularly Jewish people or really anyone has the luxury of disengaging from entirely. And I think intermission is such a comfort when you get to completely disengage and go have a drink and go to the bathroom and kind of forget for a moment and catch your breath and not that there aren't plenty of people that don't do that, which is a super valid reaction to the lights coming up and it being intermission. But I think Michael really wanted to challenge that impulse a little bit and really sort of confront the audience with the fact that there was no escaping for him, and that he spent these 2 years in isolation. And for me, it's very much about honoring that fact. You know, the show is super propulsive, and we're trying to cover a lot of ground and express a lot of ideas and big thoughts. And there isn't necessarily a ton of time to just dwell with the fact that this three-dimensional man spent the last 2 years of his life sitting alone in a room for something he didn't do. And so it allows me to kind of have this ritual of, like, no matter what other noise is happening, you know, in this award season or on any given day, or I'm hungry or I'm sad or whatever it might be, there's a point in every day to just sit with that fact and honor that fact and sort of pay homage to that fact. And I'm curious about Jessica's experience, because for me, it's so entirely different every time, both in terms of where I'm at and where reactions of others
are. What if you need a bathroom break? What if you need a glass of water? What if people are being assholes in the audience, you know, hey, bud, like, you know, like,
we certainly get that. I mean, yeah. I think the whole point is to see the variety of reaction. There are people that sit and just take it in entirely and don't move. There are people that completely disengage and go pee and have snacks, which is also totally valid. There's reactions I don't love, which is people taking videos and photos and saying, turn around, Ben, I love you, I'll take a picture of you, blah, blah, blah. So it's, you know, it's, but that's all, it comes with the territory. That's the point. I think if it was like a perfect sea of people sitting and paying respect, there would be no reason for the
right
for the conceit.
Right. And Jessica, I know you get a little bit of the weird behavior as well. This is as they're showing up, you know.
In ours, it's welcomed, though, in a weird way.
Tell me why.
Well, I think, you know, in the beginning, I didn't understand how Jamie wanted to direct this. And he just kept saying he wanted it to be relentless on me. And he didn't really want me to, he wanted me to be trapped most of the time. And the majority of the show, I can't turn away from the audience. So the audience has full access to me. And then the pre-show is when people are coming in with their drinks or whatever. They see me, I'm sitting in a chair, kind of just going in a circle. And in some sense, it's like treating me as an object to be observed. And we said in the beginning, well, you know, there's going to be people filming, there's going to be people taking pictures of me, like the whole idea of someone coming into the play because they saw Zero Dark Thirty or they saw The Help, and, you know, that bringing the history of that baggage with them of the other performances and celebrity culture. But what the pre-show does, it allows that to happen and then get dissipated. So they come, you know, they come in.
That.
Exactly. They take their pictures. There's so many times I see people taking selfies with me. They make eye contact. They say, Jessica, I love you. There's like very sweet things that they send me hearts and all this. And I stay in character and I make eye contact. That's the thing. I make eye contact with every single person in the audience.
You recognize people?
Oh my God, yeah. Bono came? I thought I was gonna die. That was so stressful.
Nora and Bono, yeah.
No, but I'm making eye contact, Al Pacino. Like, really? I'm literally making eye contact with people, like, glancing over. Sometimes I'll hold it longer if I feel like I'm being challenged in some way. But it's a way of also, it creates this sacred space in the theater. So then I think people are used to going to the theater and being like, okay, I can see the actors, but they can't see. And it's like, no, I see each and every one of you. We're doing this together. Yep. And there's a couple times in our show where my character, Nora, is confronting the outside world in some sense. So it's the beginning of the show and the end of the show. And it's the audience is supposed to go on that journey with me. And so I feel very closely connected to them in every performance because of it.
And then I guess also, because I know this has come up each year we've done a roundtable like this, I guess it gets rid of something that a lot of people don't like, a lot of actors don't like, which is entrance applause, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually, I mean, sometimes there'll be like a couple people that will applaud. Like, you know, it's like when I'm rotating before the show starts, you're thinking like, that's a bit awkward, but you know, it's fine. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, like, right. Okay.
But by the time the show starts, because slowly each of the actors, everyone in the ensemble starts to come in with their backs towards me, you know, and it's slowly as it builds. And so it gets the audience ready of like when the show starts, there's no applause. We never have anyone filming. No one's taking pictures. It's like all of a sudden, like the tone has been set. And I think it was really wonderful with Jamie.
Interesting.
Well, I love the applause. So.
That's the thing. I feel like a part of you guys has to, but you don't have to.
No.
But
my first line, you can't hear it.
That's
annoying.
True.
I can't.
It's true.
It was amazing. It was Shriek.
Character it does. It. You work so hard to be in character, then you come on stage, you're like, oh yeah, I'm also someone else.
Pulled out of the pits of hell to attend the tale, right. And I'm seeing a lady with my Christmas album T-shirt. Right. Yeah. Just, oh God, damn it.
Just wait.
You're in for a treat. You're in the splash zone.
Let's stick with Josh for a second here, though, because another thing that jars the audience at your show, not that it's unexpected for anyone who knows what Sweeney Todd's about, but just the way that you guys depict the, not stabbing, what would be the word? Just slicings?
Yeah, slicing.
Slicings.
Throat cutting,
sure. Yeah. Very impressive effects. Mm. And then also dispatching your victims down some sort of a slide-like contraption, I would imagine. Can you break it down? Yeah.
Well, when I was talking with Tommy Kail and Mimi Lin, our extraordinary set designer, we didn't want to be conceptual with the violence of the show. We wanted it to be really there and in people's face, and we wanted it to be bloody. We wanted to you know, that there's a great kind of dark, twisted humor when the body just kind of drops while singing goodbye, you know, goodbye, Joanna, you know, you're gone, and the body's going, right. And people laugh, and that's what Sondheim wanted. It's that dark, twisted kind of thing. And so the magic trick of that was always really important, that we had that stuff working. And so we're constantly fine-tuning, you know, that chair is like an old antique Chevy. Like it's really heavy, clanky, and, you know, there's a clutch, and, you know, so it was really fun to figure out how to use all that stuff, and fun to do all the special effects. It's not great for the costume department, but
it's a lot of
ironically the only way to get the fake blood out of our skin is with shaving cream. So
really,
yeah, it's
oh my
soap
God.
Doesn't do it. So we're
that's
another
hilarious.
Sick joke that they
and then did I hear they had to like kind of fine tune the slide device or something where people originally. Getting stuck on there or something?
Well, during previews, we had a couple of nights where the chair just decided to, you know, malfunction. And so, you know, there's, and I'm just up there by myself, like, and with that device, like, their safety is my responsibility.
Right.
Like, when I turn the chair and the trapdoor opens, like, I have to see that it's open all the way. I have to see that the padding's in place. And there's a lot of things I have to see before I send them down. And so when things aren't exactly right, if the slope doesn't open all the way, if something's not exactly right, I have to jump into plan or B or C mode, which is complicated when you're already doing a lot.
Yeah, you got a lot going on.
So, you know, there were times where there was one night when the chair decided to not come back up from the flat position. And so Judge Turpin, Jamie Jackson, is supposed to walk in. And of course, nothing is supposed to seem out of line. Just know he's going to die. Sorry, spoiler alert. And he goes up and he looks at it and he looks at me and we're just going to do this. All right. And he kind of sits on it, like half leaning back, like, this is fine. You know, there's nothing to see here. There's been some unintentional comedy. We've had dead bodies have to just walk off the stage at times, you know, in a very like play that goes wrong kind of way. And, you know, that's what previews are for. But it's a lot of moving parts and a lot of springs that need to be replaced and a lot of other things that need to happen and tech things happen and the audience knows. And it's already so, you know, there's already so much melodrama and comedy and stuff that sometimes, but yeah, that was frustrating when it happens, of course.
Victoria and Sarah, I want to ask you about, do you tailor your own, I guess, the voice that you would, if you were just, like you're playing a 15, 16 year old, right? She's not going to sing like Victoria Clark with your years of skill and experience. Do you curb something to be sing like
absolutely absolutely. I mean, this is, I could talk a long time about this, but I'm sitting here with three really brilliant singers, and you guys probably sing too. I haven't heard it, but Corey and Jess probably also sing, but that was a big part of the development of this character is how does she sing and how can I craft this so that the speaking voice matches up with the singing. So it's so technically I would say that when I'm singing full into my legit soprano voice, it kind of feels like I'm on like a 4-lane highway in LA, let's say.
Yeah.
And so to kind of get mentally and technically where I need to be, I have to like bring it down to 1 lane, like a twisty country road, let's say, so that I'm still on my breath and the cords are phonating healthily, but it's not as with as much muscle. And that, ironically, is very tiring.
I bet.
Because it's not what I would call the easiest sound for me to make with all of my legit and classical training, but it is the most honest sound for Kim. And so that's been part of the challenge is, and sometimes when I'm tired, I have to sing with more weight in the instrument just because it's, I just have to.
Your muscle memory knows what to do, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And you all know, you brilliant folks know, you know, just from years and years of singing, like you'll start a phrase and just from fatigue or allergy season or sinus infection or whatever, it's like you start the phrase and it's like, okay, it's like parallel parking a car, a stick shift car in San Francisco, right? Like immediately you go into technique brain and you go, okay, I'm going to have to move the sound a little bit more into my sinuses or like a little bit. Oh no, I'm going to add a little more chest here. And it's, I'm a big voice nerd. I love talking about
this.
Well,
you teach it, right? Also,
I do teach. Yeah. And I am a devotee of honest singing so that the singing has to match the moment. And I think if my whole life's work could be summed up really in making sure that whether I'm speaking or singing, the thought of the sound contains the life experience and the emotion and the honesty of the moment so that it's almost pre-programmed in a way so that like for many of us who are a kind of kinetic actors, the body, we don't tell the body how it's going to move. We just allow it to. So the dream, the goal is to have the voice do exactly what's required, nothing more, nothing less in that moment. And that's a beautiful challenge.
Wow.
But, you know,
oh, that's really
for this particular
answer.
Role, yeah.
Thank you. No, that's
tall
good.
Order.
Very, very fascinating.
You do
wait.
Impeccably.
Yeah,
and
oh,
you,
I was gonna say,
you.
I can't wait off mic to just pick your brain and just talk about voice because it's so true.
Yeah.
Well, and allergies.
Yeah.
Allergies. Yes.
All my remedies.
Yes.
All
right. Well, Sarah, I want to ask you, and then Josh, if you want to jump in afterwards. You've said, though, Sarah, that there's something about Sondheim music. I don't know if it's, I guess it's the lyrics or the pacing of it or something that is particularly challenging, even for somebody who's sung as much as you have. And, you know, I guess, can you break down why you find his music different than others?
It's very dense. It's very dense and intellectual and melodically it's really rangy. There's big intervals, you know, pitch is really important to me. Like it drives me crazy when I can't, you know, land the note. And yeah, it was I worked with Rob Berman, our music director, and we sat singing through these songs that I was, to be honest, like a little surprised. I thought it would be an easier sing because it's not, it felt like I spoke to my old music director, Nadia Di Giallonardo, who did Waitress with me. And she's like, this should be no problem. It's like right in your range. I was like,
it's rangy,
doesn't
though.
Sound like it's
rangy.
In my range.
It's a big range.
It is. Yeah, definitely the finale and the opening number. I'm singing much more legit. Sort of stylistically
you
than I normally
pull up there. I gotta thank say, you. I love that part of your voice.
Say it again, closer to the mic.
Love it so much.
And Josh, I mean, have you found that it is its own kind of unique beast as well?
Yes, there's. It's a puzzle to keep at the standard with this music that we all want to have with it. It's, of course, it's something that we all knew how complicated the score was when we went into it. The music rehearsals were long and you think you know it, you hear, other versions of it. And then there are notes in there that, you know, as you study it more and more, you think, oh, that's supposed to, that's that. Okay. And that's that. And the pitch thing is exactly right. There are things that, you know, you have to really focus. It takes just an enormous amount of focus out there. And I think the other thing that, you know, is such a great combination of the head and the heart that he wrote for this stuff. So it is really brainy, but even though the stories are so weird, you know, I mean, I always joke that like the elevator pitches for like what he might have said he was writing about next are so outrageous. Like, oh, good luck with that, Steve. Right. But he finds these common human threads through these weird stories that we all connect to. And it's the most incredible, you know, what great theater is, like edutainment. You know, I wanted to learn more about pointillist painting. I was curious about London. I wanted to know, go and learn about that Victorian London. You know, there's things that I, even as a young theater student and as a kid, found myself in these characters, even though I had nothing in common with them outside of his music and lyrics. And so, you know, leaning into the juxtaposition of what he's done there is really, really fun. He also writes a lot about, like, the action is doing something very different than what the singing is doing. And he loves that play and that balance, which is, again, takes a lot of focus, but makes it a lot of fun to do.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned, like, some of the real world, like, things you can maybe do. Maybe it's not obviously going to make a difference to go read about London at a certain time or whatever. But Ben, like, you, I read, went and tracked down the Leo Frank house in Brooklyn or whatever. Like, I think there's other variations of this. I wondered, Corey, you know, is there anything you can do aside from really just study the material to prep for what you were signing up for yours?
Yes, there's a lot. I remember we had the guys who were teaching me how to actually play the card.
Yes.
And I people know I'm clumsy as hell. So like when I'm playing,
it was unbelievable. I have to say, it was crazy. Yeah. It's like really a virtuosity. Yeah. I mean, you're doing an incredible amount of things besides.
Yes. No, thank you, man. But I remember them saying, cause like when I play spades with like my friends, I always give the cards to someone else to shuffle because I know that I don't know how to do it. They always like fly out of my hands. So like, and we take spades very seriously. But I remember them telling me, and Yahya also was never taught the hype or the trick of it. I think he may have figured it out, but he never knew how I did it each night. So he knew what it was, but he was never able to recreate it or like do, which was, I was like, yes. But, and I remember them telling me also just if I ever, you know, outside of rehearsal, when you don't have those cards on you, it should feel strange because it feels strange to those guys. Like this is their livelihood, and you have to be so good because some of those guys are going to be coming to see this show, and they did.
They're gonna know,
and they know, and you also can't. The audience can't get the trick because that's a big faux pas. Like you're not supposed to actually give up the three card Monty, and so they were very secretive about that with me, and I wasn't allowed to tell anybody in the production, and like you know, but also people still make. They hustle doing that. And so you have to be respectful of that. And also had to learn how to play the guitar and like sing in it and all of that. And it was just a lot of juggling. And you do become a student of, you know, I'm a big history nerd. So, and I love jumping into plays because you become a student of these things. You have to go and go to the house. You have to go and learn the things and really it expands who you are as a human. And as an artist. And so I just love adding those things to the basket, you know.
One last big question, and then we'll close with rapid fire if that's all right. But just, I guess a big, when I say a big question, each one of you were at one time on Broadway before the pandemic. And obviously you're back now. And I just wonder, what are the biggest changes that you've noticed for yourself, for audiences, for Broadway as a community? Just what, if anything, has changed? And anyone can jump who has something to say.
I feel like there's been, I've been thinking a lot about this a lot recently. I mean, personally, it just reminded me what I already knew, which is that I just love live theater so very, very deeply. I'm so grateful that it exists and that it was one of the only things that was like so completely untouched by not only the pandemic, but just like times continue to change and like, things are artificial and like all, like there's just a lot of things that are just shifting and shifting and shifting and there's not you can't touch the experience of watching something live. Obviously the influences and the piece in itself whatever can change, but the experience of going and watching something live is so completely untouchable that it's just really that's why I feel like it's so sacred. But I was just going to say that I feel like there is such a encouraging care, not that this didn't exist already, but a care for human beings that are in a company before there is a care for them as artists. I mean, I think that the care for them as artists is still there. And obviously there's a reverence and a respect for the work, but particularly in doing Parade and with Michael Arden, our director, it's something that's dealing with a lot of difficult conversations, anti-Semitism held in the same breath as racism and anti-Blackness and Southern versus Northern and what it means to be an American. It's just a lot of really difficult water to tread. And that would have been the case before all of this reckoning we've had as a society. And now even more so, people are afraid to tread that water. But like, if anyone asks, like, how can we hold any of those conversations together and hold space and sensitivity for all different experiences and affinity groups and types of people, like, it is so possible, because the experience that I've had in this rehearsal room is there's just so much care and time taken for making sure that we're all okay and healthy as people before we dive into the work. And when we're doing this harried, crazy thing, when especially City Center, like things where every moment is costing thousands of dollars and, you know, it can get lost and, you know, things can get rushed and pushed and it can fall to the wayside in favor of just like getting to the finish line. But never was there a difficult piece of imagery, a triggering prop. Nothing ever came into the space without the time and space to prepare for it, the recognition that it was something difficult, and the ability to have a conversation and hold each other first. And I really think that that couldn't have happened without the kind of world reckoning that has gone on. And I'm very encouraged by that moving forward, what other experiences might be like.
So sad, you know, whatever small silver lining this otherwise very traumatic couple of years we all experienced together was that we gave us, for better or for worse, a whole lot of perspective. And coming back into something that is as wonderful as this community is and doing something that is so irreplaceable like live theater, it's given us even more gratitude. I thought we already had the ceiling, but it's given us even more gratitude to be able to get out there and to share these stories. And it's also given us a filter for the other noise that comes with being in this universe, an added layer, because we're in a bubble. We're in a theater every day, and there's a lot of chatter outside, and there's a lot of noise, and there's a lot of other things that can sometimes make its way in to the sacredness of where we are. And coming out of that time where we had Zoom and no connectivity and, you know, just all those other things, it's allowed me at least to focus even more on what matters and focus even less on what doesn't, and to be able to make that space even more sacred than it was in the past.
And how about just in terms of even like, I don't know if self-care is the right word, but self-preservation. I mean, Jessica, you, what was it? The Met Gala, you were a master? It was like,
so basically we were testing every day on our show. And even if you had no symptoms, if you tested positive for COVID, you're out a week.
Yeah.
And I was meeting people at the stage door who flew from Shanghai and flew from all over the world. And so to be out of the show for a week, it just felt like it was so irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And so, no, I was wearing the mask at the Oscars.
At the Oscars.
I got quite a lot of flack for that. No, a lot of people.
Because they didn't realize why you're doing it?
No, they thought I was making some political statement. Right, I don't know what they thought. Like, I'm like, literally.
Theater people knew.
I know, theater. We knew. Well, okay, good. Well, I'll tell you, the best thing is someone at the stage door gave me a mask that said, I'm on Broadway.
Ah, that's great. That's great. Nice.
But yeah, the SAG Awards, the Oscars, you know, a lot of people were just like, what are you doing? I just couldn't get sick. And I didn't. No. I haven't missed a show.
That's great.
Yeah.
And how about compositions of audiences? Are we seeing, does the audience age-wise, anything like that, does it look different to you, Corey?
Well, it definitely, for us, which I was really grateful for, because also the students, the kids, we had a show that I was like, are you sure we bring the kids to see this? Mm-hmm. But it isn't anything that they don't see when they walk out of their doors, especially here in New York. And so it was important to expose them to that. But also, this is a generation of kids who in the past few years were deeply affected. I mean, we all were affected, but students, school, Zoom, like all of that kind of stuff, deeply affected by the lack of community and lack of interaction. And so some of them, it was their first time in seeing a show ever, a play on Broadway, off Broadway, whatever. And so this season, I think coming off of, and a bit of last season as well, but just coming off of COVID and how detrimental that was to a lot of us in mental health. It was just great to see them see this season of shows. And it was such a good season. I mean, it's such a good season.
It's a robust season, but we're not where we were.
Yeah.
We're not at the numbers that we were pre-pandemic.
In terms of attendance,
we're not.
And I think, you know, we're still looking for the audiences to not be afraid, you know, like come back to the theater. The stories we're telling now and have told this season are so beautiful, and they're so uplifting and enriching. And I think it's, yeah, that's the one message I think we really need to get out there, is that for whatever reason, if people are hesitating, you don't need to. Like it's there's only one place to get this particular kind of entertainment, this kind of experience. And I think a lot of people during the pandemic started to rely on other mediums and became very comfortable, you know, getting everything they needed from a screen. And this is not what we're doing. This is live human interaction. This is an exchange of energy with an audience that you can only get in live theater. And it's a seminal human experience that.
There's a lot of research about loneliness being this new epidemic. And I do think that it isn't just the isolation of the pandemic, but it's also the dependency on screens that we forget how to be human with each other. And that is the thing that I love so much about what you said, Ben, about, you know, there's nothing like, it's so primitive what we're doing. It's so analog. Yes. And that we stand on stage and we tell stories and we sing with our voices and we speak truth. You know, it's just a really, I think the necessity and the essential nature of that. I really believe this is essential, soul-giving, soul-saving, life-saving work that happens on stage. I really believe that.
Well, and I this may seem like a trivial thing to bring up now, but the Tony Awards, the fact that the Writers Guild has now said they will not picket the Tony Awards, could really be a lifesaver for a number of shows, right? I mean, we have two former hosts, I believe, of the Tony Awards here, Sarah, Josh. We have a lot of people who have been there before, and you guys all see what a difference it makes if you can put on a marquee or your advertisements and anything that a show is Tony nominated, Tony winning, all of that, and especially if it can be seen on the national broadcast, right? Does anyone have any thoughts about just the difference that's going to make to actually have a televised Tonys this year?
I think it's amazing that we actually get to go through with this, but I do think it highlights something that our friend Lin-Manuel Miranda probably reached out to you and talked about this with you about the Ham for Hams. He's like, you know, what it really highlights is that we are too dependent on the Tonys being the only broadcast system for this industry. We have to get more creative about other ways that people can access our beautiful program. Like there just has to be more tributaries for eyeballs to be able to know what's happening. And so they want to engage.
I also think about the fact that it impacts regionally too, because a lot of these, you know, not everyone has the time or the financial ability to get to New York.
Yeah.
And so when people see these shows or know about these shows, you can bring them to and these incredible companies and keeps other people employed and, you know, to those towns as well. And so I think there's a great need and desire for that and finding a different way to push that regionally.
And I keep thinking about the young Jessicas and the young Bens and the young Corys, young Joshes, Vickys, Sarahs. Like, did we not all watch those?
Yeah, we sat on the floor
and aspire to be a part of this community. And the future is with those young people, working with many of them now. And it's just, that's who I care about. You know, I want those young people to feel like they have access, even if it's, okay, it's not like widely viewed or whatever. It is by the people who are going to make those stories.
Yes.
Those are the people who are going to tell the story. So I think it's important.
And as a queer person, I know it's like the small, but some of my very first queer representation I remember seeing and really sinking in was when they show the nominees with whoever their person is that they've brought. So many of the theater artists have same sex, you know, people partners that they're with, that partners that, and it might, you know, even early on, as you know, as recently as like the late 90s when I was a kid watching the Tonys, it might not have been as overt as it can be now. But even then, just seeing you know, one of the guys nominated for a musical holding his man's hand or giving him a kiss when it's, you know, they're saying his name. It's like, I remember like the visceral impact of like little moments like that. So I'm just very grateful that the show gets to go on in any form for the queer people that are going to be watching, the little queer kids who I know are looking forward to this particular thing and only get it once a year, but agreed that it shouldn't be just a once a year kind of a thing.
Jessica, did you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I mean, basically, yes, I used to record the Tonys on my VHS. I don't know if everyone in this room knows what a VHS player is. And I would watch it throughout the year. I used to get American Theater Magazine, yeah. And I dreamed of someday living in New York with my people. And I love being on stage, but I also love being in an audience, mm-hmm. and watching these productions. And I think also the beautiful thing about the Tonys is for the people who don't have a lot of finances to be able to go see, you know, the theater at a certain point. I mean, for me, it created a love of theater that then I would go to community productions. You know, I'd watch the Tonys and then we would do a Best of Broadway review in Sacramento, California, you know? So it really, I think it's so important to have that outreach to keep live theater accessible to people who can't afford it. Necessarily.
I just wanted to say one more thing.
Yeah.
As Corey said earlier, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. Like, we're only as good as what we're given to speak and sing. So, of course, we're all supportive of this strike. And we want them to succeed and be paid what they deserve. We're all members of multiple unions here. So I feel like it's incredibly, it's gritty. And it's tough what they're doing, but we are behind
some
them.
Of you, if and when you get up there, it might be something that comes up, I imagine. So anyway.
It's unscripted, so.
It's unscripted, yeah. Right.
Is anyone here in the WGA?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Sarah, you are. Did you think this is how it would shake out in terms of that they would kind of grant essentially not a waiver, but
I'm so grateful that this is how it shook out. I think, and I don't blame the WGA. I think that they're the you know, it needs to be a strict sort of protocol. But I do think that there are a lot of playwrights that are TV writers. Like, it's just they can't make a living being a playwright. So they have to go to other mediums. So I think it ends up inadvertently punishing the wrong community. And it's a community that really needs eyes on it, and it's eyes for the right reasons, I think. Right. So I'm so thrilled, and I think, you know, it's going to be, it reminds us that it isn't really about the script, that's this night is about celebrating theater as a medium, as a community, as a collection of stories and artists who bring this to life and want to, you know, project that into the world. It doesn't feel like a competition. It really, really doesn't. It feels like a celebration to me. Like, that is how, which I think is so, coming from music, I always was so sort of destabilized by the way music can feel competitive. Like, there isn't, it's a scarcity mentality. Like, there's not enough for everybody. And I think because theater has to move and change so much, and nothing lives forever. I mean, Phantom is gone. You know what I mean? Like, it's right. Nothing lives forever here. So we just, you can't sustain the delusion that you're actually in competition with anybody. We're just celebrating incredible performances.
When we were about to host it, I reached out to Corden, who hosted it, and said, like, is this going to be a nightmare? Like, is this going to be, what is this? What are you, advice?
You asked after you agreed to host? You got to ask
No, before I agreed.
Oh, before, okay.
just kind of said, like, what am I getting myself into? Any advice?
Right.
And he said, you know, for every other award show, there is that feeling, and it's like everybody's there with their entourages of 50 people. And, and when you're in front of those people at the Tonys, every single person in those seats have wanted it since they were 5 years old. And they've worked their asses off to be there. And like Sarah was saying, there isn't as competitive a feeling. Everybody there is so excited that the night is going to project what we all love about this world to so many people. And everybody's just supportive of that. And I know that I speak for everybody in this room that we can't wait to do what we do on that night for the next Sweeney watching, the next Baker's Wife watching. You know, we're
the next Nora.
The next Nora watching, absolutely, because they're watching. And, you know, they were us.
And I guess it's not a coincidence. I will say, as somebody who covers all the different award shows, and many of you have been at them, this is definitely the most entertaining to watch.
Yes, yeah,
you guys
sure.
are actually yes. doing what you are yeah. being recognized for doing.
I mean, it is the best award show.
Yeah.
You have a good time.
Yeah.
It is a hell of a lot of fun.
Remember, because this is a, I mean, VHS. I remember they used to do scenes from plays.
Yeah, of course.
Are you volunteering to do that?
No. I love it.
I think we should bring it back.
At the Tonys, they used to do a scene from a play.
Yeah. I remember Viola Davis.
Yes.
I remember them doing it from King Hadley and just being like, oh yeah. And you lean in.
Yeah, exactly right. That's great. So all right, last minute here. Just please shout out first thing that occurs to you. Excluding family, the person whose attendance at one of your performances of the show you're nominated for has meant the most to you?
Lee Bowman.
Mary Beth Peel.
Jeffrey Wright.
Cool.
Lem Khereib.
Nice.
Joanna Gleason came.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Most unusual thing in your dressing room for this show?
Ooh.
A neon Jewish star sign. And my walls are pink.
My dog.
Your dog. Okay, cool.
My original rehearsal music from Sunday in the Park with George.
Wow. Taking it. Same
back in the day when Maddie Pincus used to be the music copyist by hand and the music folios for rehearsals were about 11 by 13.
But again, in the actual theater where you did that.
Correct. And it's framed.
That's cool.
I have pictures of actresses on my wall.
Anyone specific?
Viola Davis, Lee Holman, Isabelle Huppert, Catherine Deneuve.
Nice.
Vanessa Redgrave.
Nice.
I kind of collect, my grandfather collected pennies, and every now and then I find like a lucky penny, and I've got a Victorian era penny in my dressing room from the time period that Sweeney
would have been. That's cool.
I have a picture of just an old print of original print of Grace Jones, and that's just such a.
Most annoying thing that audiences did at one of your performances of this show.
Oh, I've got something. Towards the end of the show, Torvald says to Nora, "Where are you going?" I say, "To take off my costume." And when I say to take off my costume, one woman, I think she probably was deep in the cups, yelled out to Aryan, "You take off your costume, buddy."
Oh my God. Probably cut her off.
Cut her off.
She's at the bar. Just going.
That's where you go to Doll's House to get drunk. That's
heckle the men.
Yeah.
But actually, it's been interesting that the women are heckling the men.
Yeah, right.
Something to be examined.
Yes. Exactly.
I mentioned, but someone played the entirety of Thinking Out Loud by Ed Sheeran in their purse.
On their phone.
I like a good volume. I like a hearable volume.
But they didn't hear it.
Bless her heart, didn't hear it and didn't notice it at all and just kind of watched the scene attentively and it played for a good full minute.
Did it change the way you approach your character?
It made me scream a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like people like that actually know it's playing, but they don't want to be the person to like
acknowledge that it was them, right?
They're going to sit there and let it go.
Pretend it's not happening.
I remember at the very end of the play, that it's all about the inheritance, you know, that stocking that the brothers are talking about the entire play, and at the very end it rolled off the stage and he has to give it to me, and the whole thing was on the stocking and it rolled off the stage, and this kid picks it up and Yaya sort of kind of goes over like, you know, and thinks the kid is going to put it back, and the kid's just like to his friends, and he was just like, "No, I'm keeping this. This is my souvenir." Oh my God. We didn't get it back. Yaya had to go and find like a piece of paper towel.
Wow.
Like the theater.
You hear a lot about like jukebox music, like it's people singing along.
Yeah.
With Sweeney, it's kind of a hard show to sing along to.
Yeah.
But like people who like love this score a lot, there was a guy that we noticed was very, very largely conducting the whole show in his seat. And probably more annoying for our music director than anyone else.
Right.
But yeah, he was into it. I mean, we respect the panelists.
We get a lot of young people who come to see Kimberly Akimbo, and sometimes way too young. But yeah, we've had mothers holding 3-year-olds, which is like way too young to see Kimberly Akimbo. But there was a group that came from Lodi, New Jersey, and that's a town that's referenced in the show. And every time we said Lodi, they stood up and screamed. And in the last scene, there's, you know, it starts to get serious. In the second act, it starts to spiral downward pretty rapidly. And so we had to, you know, we were making up ways to say the lines without Lodi so that we wouldn't get a laugh.
That's great.
Yeah.
It wasn't annoying, but it was impactful. Jennifer Lopez came to the show, and she came in a little bit late, and she was wearing a full sparkly one, like a onesie. I think it was a light color, and she came with an entourage, and she came in kind of like a little bit late, and it was just so, I was like, well, and Jennifer Lopez is watching the show now. Just like distracting because I'm a fan, and I'm like, now I'm looking at Jennifer Lopez walking down the aisles.
Last two. If you could snap your fingers and make it so, what would be the ideal number of performances of your show per week?
We're doing 7, and that's like, that's a good number for me.
Like, yeah, with that. Okay.
I think that's a good amount of time. And it wasn't really even like for the singing. It was like, there's just a lot of yelling. And I just was like, I was thinking of protection, but it has worked out for everybody. We really like that.
So 7 though is 1 2-day and 5
two,
or whatever.
So we're two on Wednesday, 2 on Saturday, but we start on Wednesday.
So yeah, you though, again, you can do whatever you want here. Do you want one every day, or you like having?
I am a weirdo who likes being marinated for that second show.
Okay.
I really like, I like just holding up in my dressing room and playing my Nintendo for 3 hours and then like drinking tea and feeling like I've done the show, so I'm not worried about it. I can do the show like I am every other day. And I feel like then I just coast. So I'm weird. I like the 2 shows.
Okay. Anyone else?
Mine might not be popular, but I'm happy to do 8 shows because I know theater needs it. And we're so I'm happy to do it, but I would prefer to do 5 shows.
5.
Yes. Of this play, because I have like a emotional craze. I'm like crying for an hour. So. Yeah. It's for to do that 8 times a week feels a lot.
So 5 on 5 different days or some 2
on days? Different days would be great. Okay. Listen, that'll never happen. And I love the theater so much. I'm very happy to do 8.
Right.
But if it's my personal preference,
that's what we're
if someone
there.
Else wants to buy out the other shows for me, some benefactor, I'm into
You're
it.
You're available. Okay.
I think 6 is a good number. I'm actually trying to talk to the union about this because I'm a counselor, an equity counselor, and I think we need to move away from 8 a week. I really do. I think it's too much. Mm-hmm. But I know that it's the financial formula for now, but I think we need to rethink it. And I think 7 is more humane, but I think in this particular show, I think 1 a day would be good for moi. Now, I'm doing 8 and I enjoy them, but
it's a lot.
It is.
Sorry.
I think 7 would be a sweet spot, 6 or 7. I really think you need a week. You need 2 days off in a row.
I agree.
I could deal with a 7 show, I think it's relatively inhumane to only get 1 day off because it's just
the rest of the world gets 2 days.
Yeah, the rest of the world. It's not fair to be expected to rest and rejuvenate because you're so exhausted.
And balance. We need balance with our family.
Yes.
Yeah. Makes you strong.
Yeah, family. That is the thing.
Ari and Ben, I
also agree. I think here's the thing. I'm also a bit of, I like the idea of 8 shows because I like that's the thing that sharpens the muscle. Like that's why Broadway isn't easy. That's why the people who do this are able to do it. And they are clinicians and technicians and just, you know, intuitive. But I think given this season, again, a lot of our shows are so heavy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to have to be asked to do that sometimes, like 2 shows 2 times a week.
Correct.
I mean, it's such a task and it's such an ask. And then to have only 1 day off, which we then also have to work
exactly
on those days.
And today's our day off, just for everyone listening at home.
Really? and
well,
families.
Better today than on a day when you had a show. Sure.
But you have families and you have to just, you know, do laundry or like, you know, like there are things that, but I appreciate the rigor.
Yeah.
And I think there's still some work to be done there.
Right.
And the holiday season is insane.
Shout out to 9 others who keep us very, very sane throughout this. I'm very patient.
Yes.
Ben, did you have a number?
I like the 7. I mean, I would go back in time and do 3 Evan Hansens a week, not 8.
Yeah.
But I think 7. I mean, if it's like a Sophie's choice between the two, I would keep the only 1 day off, but I would chuck the Wednesday matinee so far out to the ocean and never do
it actually,
again.
So that's I know I said one last question, but just a follow-up to that one. If you're an audience member and you're – this is, I guess, a really tough question, but, like, what's the show that they should put last?
What's the best show? What's the worst
show? What's the one that you should skip?
Saturday night. Do not
– Don't come on Saturday night?
No.
Is that when you're most burned out?
Oh, I love Saturday night on Broadway.
Yeah, I like Friday night on Broadway.
I'm burnt.
You're burnt.
I'm crispy. I like a crispy Friday piece of bacon.
crispy piece of bacon. So, all right. Well, I appreciate it.
Avoid Tuesdays. Just like, at least.
Coming back into it.
It's like, great on it. Tuesday. Oh, no. Tuesday, I'm like, what day is it?
I'm like, what show is it?
Yes, what show?
Because I've forgotten, just go back and you go, okay. Reset.
So
okay.
It's better once you're really on the wheel.
I love a good Friday night.
A Shabbat show.
Yeah. Well, a Shabbat show.
I don't like Fridays. I like Thursdays and I like Saturdays.
No, there's a
Thursday's
crew that
no payday, Sundays. Everyone.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Thursdays.
Everyone who's listening. So that helps. Thursday is always pretty
good. But come
jolly.
Any night.
Like, yeah, come
of course.
Come
you get a grace.
There's no wrong show. Every show is consistent and perfect. Come anytime. Yeah.
There you go. All right.
There you go, Josh.
Thanks for coming to Sweeney Todd. We appreciate you.
Last one. Put it out into the universe. If you could play any role on the stage in the future, which would it be? And I believe that Corey has an answer I've read elsewhere.
Yes.
Please.
It's Sweeney Todd.
Really?
Is it really?
Wait, which one were you?
Sam Cooke.
Oh, Sam Cooke. Oh, no. Well, actually, okay, first of all, I do want to sing. I do want to sing, but okay. I've been telling people that, like, I can't wait to come see Sweeney Todd because I'm obsessed with that show. So, okay. Yes, Sweeney Todd. Ooh, and I'm also Josh, you know, here's my guy.
Yeah.
But Sam Cooke has been just such a dream role for me. And so we've been thinking about how to get it to screen and, you know, all of that. And I'm like, it might be a good idea.
So it is brewing.
To cook in on the stage and see sort of what happens with it. So such a tragic story how his young life, but like so impactful. So
okay, so that's Corey. And that's people are hopefully listening. Jessica.
I have one. Alma from Summer and Smoke. Tennessee Williams said that it was the part that he felt the closest to, and I think it's not performed that much, that play. I love it so much.
Okay.
George, it's under the mark with George.
Yeah.
Since I was a wee, wee child.
That's always been one.
Before I leave the earth, I will do it.
Okay, great.
I would love to do another original show. Mm. Yeah. I like working on new pieces, so... Cool. Anybody out there who's got...
I love it. Josh, close us out.
I so loved working with Dave Malloy on Great Comet, and I'm always fascinated with what he's going to cook up next. So I would say, like Victoria said, something new, something that, you know, I could dive into and be the first, you know, to, like Len did for Sweeney all those years ago. I also really loved his octet, and I love... It kind of brought me back to like my choir days of like just all the harmonies and all the things that that cast has to be a part of in the ensemble of that. So I would say something probably in that.
Nice. Well, on behalf of The Hollywood Reporter and everybody listening, I cannot thank you guys enough for taking, as we've just established, your one day off and sharing some of it with us. Thank you. Really appreciate it. And we will make sure that if people didn't know about any of these shows before, the ones that they can still go and see, sadly, we no longer have Into the Woods or Top Dog Underdog, but
you can see it on tour. You can see it on tour.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
When do you guys close? I'm closing June 10th.
June 10th. Yeah, this is good to know, actually. Yeah.
Doll's House, its last performance is June 10th.
Okay.
Never. We're never closing.
Never closing.
Kimberly Akimbo will run forever.
Sweeney Todd?
Mid-January.
Mid-January.
Me. I think we'll go on after that.
Okay. And Parade?
Parade, August 6th, Hard Stop.
All right. Get going, people. Get your tickets. And, thank you guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.
At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.